Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, here as always with editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, Yaakov Katz. And if you hear some little voices in the background, hopefully you won't because I have a closed door and good equipment. But if you do, it's because the teachers are on strike yet again here in Israel.
And this strike is truly annoying. I can't complain too much, though, Lahav, because I'm currently in the United States on a trip. But my wife back home, Chaya, has been taking kids to work with her because there's nothing to do with them. And it's either leave them at home and let them watch on their phones and iPads, or at least take them to work and try to get them to move and think a little. But this has been ridiculous, what's happening over the last week.
So I had almost the same situation as you because, and I don't think you know this, my husband was on a business trip and then he caught COVID on the business trip. So I've been, almost the same situation as your wife. I mean, I've been taking care of the kids alone throughout most of this strike. But the solution here where I live has been that if you pay for aftercare, like the extra hours from 2 to 4, they've had sort of like a camp. So instead of them like learning with like professional teachers, they have babysitting most of the day. Although today it was only half a day just for technical reasons. But most of the cities in Israel have not been able to manage that. And I see all over social media, people, you know, I see my friends, I see Communications Minister Yoaz Hendel, who brought his kids to the Knesset. Like
for a late night of voting, right?
Yeah, it's just thrown the country into disarray.
Picture that I think you also retweeted of him schlepping, you know, carrying a sleeping kid on his shoulder because his wife, who's a doctor, wasn't able to be home and they couldn't get a babysitter. So you had to bring him to the Knesset. I think we probably all agree that teachers need to be paid more. Right? I mean, that's obvious, right?
For sure.
You know, just so our listeners understand, if you're a teacher in your first year, you're getting paid maybe 6,000-7,000 shekel, right? Which is about, I don't know, $2,500.
$6,000
shekel. Yeah. So let's say it's about not even $2,000, right? And that is...
That's before taxes.
And that's, yeah, but I doubt there's much taxes when you're getting paid such a low amount of money. But anyhow, I mean, it's not sustainable. Teachers cannot live. And who's going to want to go be a teacher, right? If these are the people who are responsible for the education of our children, who would in their right mind go be a teacher when they know they're not going to be able to make it? And it doesn't get that much better as the years go by. You start to make a little more money, but I have a friend who, for example, is a principal of a school. He's not raking it in and he's working like crazy. So it's not sustainable. The country does need to do more. It is a public education system. I mean, the problem is that the budgets are limited, right? And there's only so much that the state can give, but this is why the teachers have been striking, is to try to get some more money.
Right. So Israel's expenditure per student is very high and it's grown over the years. And yet it doesn't seem to be spent in any efficient way, right? Like when you look at our results, they're not so amazing compared to other countries in the OECD and not compared to countries that spend what we spend per student. So part of the proposal that the finance ministry wants is they'll increase starting salaries, but they also want raises to be tied to results so that good teachers are getting raises as opposed to it just being about the clock ticking. And the teachers' unions oppose that, which I think is unfortunate. But I also think just this tactic of using strikes is, first of all, it's not really helping because there's a limit to what this government can do since, as we will discuss soon, we're about to go into an election season and they can't make huge budgetary decisions. But also, it really creates antagonism and hostility. It feels old school at this point. Like, I feel like it's been years since there's been a big strike like this in Israel, although you've had kids in school for longer, so you would know better than me. And I think that people really resent it. I know teachers who resent it because they want to close out the school year also. Like, and even more, it just is adding to the trauma that kids have because we didn't come out of, you know, COVID and all the lockdowns were not that long ago. And they missed so much school and they had so much uncertainty. And now they have to sort of go back to that where, you know, you don't know when you're going to school and all of a sudden your school shut down and you didn't get a chance to say goodbye to your friends and your teachers.
You know what you also learned from this whole thing? I mean, there was a running joke for years. I now have a daughter who's post-high school, is actually going to the army in a couple months. But so I've been in the part of the Israeli education system as a parent for a long time. But every summer, it's always, you know, school won't start on September 1st. There's always a threat of school not beginning on time because of some teacher strike over the summer or threats of a strike. But Yaffa Ben-David, who is the head of the teachers union, has proven once again to probably be one of the more powerful people in our country, and her ability to get what she wants and just keep, you know, paralyze an economy to an extent. Because like you were saying, you know, you got little kids at home. Parents can't go to work. They have to stay home. They have to find something. They have to scramble. They have to spend money that they weren't planning on spending. It's not just a small little thing. It's a huge thing when there is a teacher strike. And it's going to be one of the problems, and I hope that it gets solved, but we're talking on the eve of the collapse of this government, right? The Knesset has already voted through the bill to dissolve, or disperse the Knesset through its first reading. There's supposed to be a vote now for the second and third reading. We're talking on the eve of that vote, but it looks pretty sure that that's going to pass. It passed the first reading, I think, 110-0. There were no objections. It was almost the entire...
And by the time this podcast goes up, probably we will be heading to an election. The Knesset will be dispersed and we will have a new prime minister.
So tell us, Lahav, I mean, you spent a lot of time with Yair Lapid over the years, back when you were covering the Knesset and he was a newly elected Knesset member and minister, but also especially over the last year when he's been foreign minister and you've been covering the foreign ministry as our diplomatic correspondent. What do you think? I mean, what do you think he'll do? And will he even have an opportunity, because we're going to be in an election campaign, to make a difference and to leave a mark as Israel's prime minister?
I think it'll be very hard for him to make a difference and leave a mark because, well, it depends, right? I think we discussed this last week. He might end up only being prime minister to like the end of this year. Or if there's another election, which unfortunately has been the trend the past few years, then he'll be prime minister longer. But there's a limit on what kinds of decisions can be made when you're in an interim government and the Knesset is not passing laws. So I don't know that he'll be making such a huge mark. However, he will be the person greeting President Joe Biden when he lands in Israel in about 2 weeks. So that will certainly help him in his election campaign, and we'll have those photos for, you know, posterity.
Yeah, and images is, you know, appearances and imagery is very important, especially in an election. And of course, that'll play a role. But you know, it mostly, like you just said, it's a caretaker government, right? So when you're interim prime minister, you're limited in the decisions that you can make. I think where you can mostly influence matters of the nation is when it comes to foreign policy and it comes to engaging with the world. And I'm guessing, you know, Biden's visit, that's going to be a big one and a feather in Lapid's cap, but he'll probably make a couple of trips outside the country, I would bet. Like he'll probably go somewhere, you know, to the to the Gulf maybe, or to the United States even, to Europe. Like he'll want to show his foreign policy credentials, because that's at least where he can do something big. And otherwise, I wonder what his campaign will look like as prime minister, right? He'll want to highlight Bibi's, Netanyahu's divisive character and rhetoric, right? That's something that he's often spoken about. But he's also going to want to play it in the Hebrew word is mamlachti, right? Like statesmanlike, especially now as prime minister. So he'll have to be careful, no? In the way he kind of runs his campaign.
Yes, definitely. But the just being prime minister will boost his campaign so much, right? Like the amount of airtime you get just by being the person in that seat is worth millions in campaign funds. So that, I think, is going to help him a lot. I will say, you know, I said that there's not a lot of decisions you can make, not a big impact you have, but actually the decisions that he can make are about national security. And not that I'm saying that something big will happen in the next 6 months, I don't know, but you know, Menachem Begin, for example, was prime minister of an interim government when Israel bombed the reactor in Iraq. So who knows?
Right.
Start with that.
That's true. Although I don't see Lapid doing it, but it is interesting, especially
when
we talk about nuclear threats. Iran, of course, you know, always in the headlines, and we always talk about it on the podcast.
And Iran talks are back now.
Right. The Iran talks are back. But I think what's more interesting at the moment, from our perspective at least, is this debate that came out in the press this week about between the Mossad and parts of the IDF of whether it's good to return to the JCPOA or it would be bad for Israel to return to the JCPOA. And just to explain, the Mossad is said to be adamantly opposed. The new head of the relatively new head of the Mossad, I think he's been there already a year, David Barnea, has taken a more aggressive approach. And based on a lot of reports that we've seen recently coming out of Iran, assassinations and cyber attacks and explosions, it seems that the Mossad has been very busy there in doing some of these things, apparently. On the other hand, you have people in military intelligence, what's known by its Hebrew acronym Aman, as part of the IDF, and Aaron Khalifa, the head of military intelligence, which has been arguing that Israel should actually support a return to the JCPOA because that would buy time for Israel to prepare a better military option if and when it would need.
I think that it's a little more, I think support is a bit of a strong word.
Well, I guess maybe
but
not.
But yes, but that the plus side of it is that it buys time.
It buys time. And that this has been something, and it's come out at an interesting time, right? Someone has leaked this to the media right as the government's meant to transition, a new prime minister is supposed to come into office, and Biden is set to visit, and the Iran talks are resuming. So clearly there's some attempt to influence something that's happening. And I mean, do you think Lapid's going to take a different approach here? Because Bennett and Netanyahu before him were very anti-JCPOA. Do you think Lapid might go in a different direction?
Well, first of all, just a little insider info for our listeners, and I feel perfectly comfortable saying this because the information was not leaked to me, but I know this from my colleagues, that it's the Mossad leaking it. So I guess the Mossad thinks that this makes Aman look bad. Otherwise, it wouldn't be coming from the Mossad. But also, notably, Aviv Kochavi, the IDF chief of staff, is on the side of the Mossad. So there's this interesting internal dynamic in the IDF where there's differences of opinion coming out.
And he's also, you know, nearing the end of his term, which is going to be coming at some point also to an end. So there's some kind of jostling for influence, it seems, right?
Definitely. It's a very interesting behind the scenes politics. But I think as long as you have a situation where the Mossad is strongly opposed and the IDF chief of staff is strongly opposed, and you have someone like Lapid where national security is not his forte, and he really has very little background in it. I mean, he's been a member of security cabinets, but, he didn't have like an operational role in the army. He was a journalist for the Army magazine, like my grandmother, by the way.
And by the way, like Ehud Olmert before him, who served as prime minister also.
Yes. Yeah. So there aren't a lot of prime ministers like this. I mean, because arguably Begin and Shamir, they had a security background that predated the IDF, but still had one. So there's very few prime ministers like this, but it has happened before. But I find it hard to think that a prime minister like that would stand up to these people. Although, I don't know, you wrote the book on this. So I don't know if Olmert was standing up to people when he decided to bomb the Syrian reactor. I keep talking as if Lapid's going to bomb a reactor. I really have no knowledge or don't actually think that's going to happen. It's just the example I keep thinking of.
Because, hey, Israel's always doing it, right? So, you know, and it also happens often in the summer. The OC Iraq bombing was in June. The Al-Kibar, the Syrian bombing, was in September. So, you know, it takes place in these good months of the year, right? And now we have a government that's moving in. So you never know, right? Anything's possible. But no, I mean, kidding aside, I think you're right that I don't see Lapid making a big change in that sense. On the other hand, I mean, he has been the architect of this attempt to kind of get along better with the Democratic administration of Joe Biden in the United States. I think that we can all assume that if Netanyahu was prime minister over the last year, the relationship would not be the same that it is now.
But you know what? Like, people keep saying that Lapid's going to go along to get along, sort of. But this week, I mean, the person who orchestrated these like renewed Iran talks is Josep Borrell, who's like the foreign minister of the European Union. And Lapid, well, they exchanged messages, and he wrote a very strongly worded message to Borrell saying that this is a mistake and that this is putting Israel in danger. So Lapid has also considered improving relations with the EU to be very important. So I give him credit, you know, and giving him future credit to think that he will stand up when it's important, even if he really wants to improve these relationships.
And Lahav, what happens to Naftali Bennett?
Well, so we in the Jerusalem Post were the first, I believe, to report back in April that in a rotation agreement, Bennett will be responsible for the Iran portfolio. So he will actually be the person in charge of Iran policy. And that was reaffirmed last week after Bennett said that he's stepping down as prime minister. I have doubts that that can really truly be the case, that the buck will stop with him on Iran when someone else is prime minister. But frankly, Iran is a full-time job.
Right. But I mean, there are.
And he'll be running a campaign.
And there are mechanisms, but there are systems in place, right? There's the National Security Council, there's the Security Cabinet, there's the Defense Ministry, the IDF, the Mossad, which reports to the Prime Minister, and of course, the Prime Minister. So obviously, while he can play a big role, he's got to play ball as a team player with a lot of other people.
For sure.
Wow. But if you think that Israel's crazy, right, all you have to do is look across the Atlantic and find a country called the United States where the conversation always seems to be about just two issues, gun laws and abortion. And on this week's podcast, we actually bring on Rabbi David Wolpe, who was once named by Newsweek magazine as the most influential pulpit rabbi in the United States. He's a prolific writer and author of a number of books and a wonderful speaker, and wrote a column actually for the Jerusalem Post on Parshat HaShavua for a number of years. So one of the leading Jewish characters and leaders in the United States. And he gave a fantastic sermon that you came across, Lahav, on Twitter about abortion and kind of how it's looked at through Jewish law. And it's actually very interesting the way Israel approaches abortion and the way the United States approaches abortion. One thing that we didn't talk to him about in the podcast, in the interview, which I'm curious what you think about this, Lahav, is that in Israel, it's not an issue, right? Abortion, you would think, right? There's no separation of religion and state in Israel. So complicated. But in Israel, it's not even something that people talk about. Definitely not a political issue at all.
No, and I remember several years ago, there was like sort of a change suggested. So just to explain to people, in Israel, you don't have the right to an abortion, but 98% of women who want to get an abortion can get one. They're approved by a committee that you have to go to, and you have to be able to follow certain criteria, whether it's babies conceived out of wedlock, you're younger than 18 or older than 40, which older than 40 is an interesting one. Is conceived from rape or incest, fetus has a birth defect, and then this is the big one, the common one: the pregnancy poses a risk to the physical or mental health of the mother. And I think that that's like, it's an expansive condition that many women can find ways to fall under, and that's how you reach the 98% number. In any case, there's a committee. There's a doctor, there's a social worker. Not sure who else is in the committee. I think it's three or four people. And a few years ago, there was an Arab Knesset member, and then Yehuda Glick from Likud, who is actually a rabbi, and they wanted to add a religious figure to the committee. And so then we suddenly had a big political abortion controversy in Israel, where a lot of people really didn't like it. The law didn't go anywhere. And you're right that overall it's not a political issue. And actually this week Israel approved certain reforms that would make it a lot easier to get an abortion, especially if it's through a pill as opposed to like a medical procedure. And there was very little like controversy or debate about it. Haredi Knesset members, Shas and Unity Torah, Judaism opposed it, but overall it just wasn't a partisan political issue.
Let me just say that this committee that you spoke about, which makes it seem like very complicated, very, very easy to go through, right? It's just meets, and I know from accompanying this throughout once or twice, is not that complicated to go through the loops or the hoops of this thing.
Right. I mean, there are some women who find it like offensive or like overly invasive.
Yeah, but when you consider what's about to happen in Alabama, where you can't even for a birth defect get an abortion in Israel. And I shouldn't laugh. It's not funny, but you can't even do that in Alabama.
Yeah.
In Israel, those things just are easy. That's like just a quick sign off and that's taken care of. So, it's interesting because we tend to think of Israel as being this, anachronistic religious state of sorts, but really here there's a lot more nuance. And anyhow, we talk about this a lot with Rabbi Wolpe. Fascinating conversation. Here we go.
So we have have a special guest this week, Rabbi David Wolpe, who writes for the Jerusalem Post about the weekly Torah portion, and is the rabbi, or the soon-to-be rabbi emeritus at the Sinai Temple in Los Angeles. And he gave a sermon last week, right after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, about the Jewish perspective on abortion. And this is, of course, something that so many people have been discussing over the past week that we wanted to invite him here to sort of share that perspective with our listeners. So thank you for being here, Rabbi.
Thank you for inviting me.
There were some Jewish organizations that supported the overturning of Roe v. Wade, like Agudat Israel of America. And then a lot more organizations, I guess, because the Haredim are a small minority of Jews in America, right, who opposed it, and some were a little more neutral. Where do you stand on this issue?
The central issue for me is, first of all, obviously, turning back Roe v. Wade means you're going to get a patchwork of different kinds of laws, some of which will amount to a total ban on abortion, which is what seems to be happening in Alabama, where even in cases of rape or incest, abortion is not allowed. And you can get laws such as the state I live in California, where abortion on demand is allowed. And you can make a Jewish case for most things along the way. I mean, the sort of clear polls are, it is not equivalent to murder in Jewish law. That's based on Exodus, where, you know, if a miscarriage is caused by striking a woman, whether advertently or inadvertently, it's a fine as opposed to capital punishment, which is the punishment for murder. So it's not equivalent to murder. On the other hand, Jewish law takes abortion, especially after the 40th day, because there's some argument about whether up to the 40th day there's any restriction at all. But especially after the 40th day, Judaism takes abortion very seriously and doesn't see it as nothing. So the point that I made was that I've sat in my office and seen young girls who felt like an abortion was really the only way to save their lives. And that I was aware that I was representing a tradition which, until 30 to 50 years ago, did not, in any halakhic opinion, enshrine a woman's voice. And so for me to say it's impossible under Jewish law for you to do that, which to you seems the only way out of a life crushing and soul crushing dilemma, is impossible. And I don't think that as Jews, we ought to impose that, especially not in societies or those elements of the Jewish world in which men's voices are the only ones that have a role in the halachic arena.
Rabbi Wolpe, in the sermon that you gave last Friday at Sinai Temple, which I thought was very interesting and moving, but also you talk about the nuance between, I guess, in Jewish law and halacha, of how abortions work and how the Jewish law and scholars look at the obvious preference across the board you spoke about to the life of the woman. If there's ever a risk, right, it's clear as daylight that takes precedence. But it seemed very nuanced in Jewish law, as opposed to the debate yeah. here in the United States, where it became very political, right? And I'm wondering if there was something that maybe the conversation in the U.S. could have taken from the Jewish conversation over this very difficult issue.
Not just that it's political, but it's very binary, right? Like either
right.
people talk about either you could have an abortion whenever you want, or none at all.
Right. And I think you're both exactly right. So when you talk about it, the life of the mother taking precedence, in various instances, sorry, this is expanded to the health of the mother in different ways. So Rav Jacob Emden, for example, who was a famed scholar and a very controversial scholar in lots of ways, talks about it being a question of mental anguish. Rav Uziel, who was the Sephardic chief rabbi before the state of Israel, allows the same. And the question is, how, I first of all, where along the term you're talking about, because late-term abortions are a very different question halachically and just, I think, to our inherent moral sense from early abortions. And also, what does it mean? Like, how much risk does there have to be to a mother in order for us to feel as though this is a mandatory procedure? All those things get lost in this very left-right, yes-no, can't kind of debate that we're having in the United States. And unfortunately, as you know, as the debate continues, it tends not to get more nuanced. It tends to get more a reflection of the solidarity of each team, in quotes. And that's unfortunate.
So the conversation, though, in your synagogue, which I found, which you mentioned in your sermon, was one that was kind of split, right? There were, you gave the sermon on Shabbat morning during services, your synagogue, the Sinai Temple, had put out a statement alongside almost every Jewish organization in the United States, right? Those in favor, right. Those against, but everyone had said something on this very hotly contested issue. But you mentioned that there were people who said, what are you even putting out a statement? Why are you weighing in on this? Right. This is not an issue for a rabbi or for a shul to even engage on. And again, to me, it seems obvious that it is, because it is a religious issue, right? End of life, right. Things, you know, religious legal questions. But people thought it wasn't. And I'm guessing they didn't want you wading into political waters. So
exactly so. So I have a very politically divided congregation. I mean, really, mamash divided, like right and left. People who loved Obama, people who detested Obama, people who loved Trump, people who detested Trump, all sides. And so I try very hard for that reason, and also for a whole variety of reasons that we can talk about another time, to stay away from political issues and questions. This, I really do believe, is an important moral question that Judaism has a lot of writing about and halachic opinion about. And I felt it was, as I said in the sermon, a dereliction of duty to stand up there and say, well, I know we're having this huge debate about an urgent moral question, but really, as a rabbi, I have nothing to say about it. That just seemed to me silly. The other interesting thing that I want to say about the reaction that has struck me and continued still this morning, because there are excerpts of my sermon like going around Instagram and other places, is that I know there are a lot of polls that are contradictory about the gender divide in abortion, whether women in fact support it more than men do or not. It depends which poll you read. But I can tell you from my informal poll, every single objection to the sermon so far that I have received has come from a man. Everyone. And women have been uniformly supportive and encouraging, which I just found striking. And it made me feel as though I have about 60 to 70% of my congregation is Iranian. And I think many of them come from a background where, again, a generation or two ago, women had absolutely no voice. And I think that some of that community is feeling like I gave women in that community a louder voice. And for that, I'm grateful.
So a lot of the comments from the American Jewish community on Roe have been focused on it as a religious freedom issue. The argument sort of being that if a woman is in a situation where she's halachically required to have an abortion because the baby threatens her life, and of course there are very broad definitions of what threatens her life means, but leaving that aside,
yes,
that, and they live in a place like Alabama or Mississippi, they won't be able to observe their religion. Do you think that do you think there's a strong argument there that this is a violation of freedom of religion for Jews?
I made a little bit of that argument in the sermon, and I think that it is possible that that could be the case. I don't think it's the strongest argument, because my guess is that, first of all, the only like clear unitary voice with which Judaism speaks about this is life of the woman. And I don't know if any of the laws, and I'd have to check this, say that if the life of the mother is threatened, abortion is still outlawed. I know the Alabama law says rape or incest. I think the Mississippi law is 15 weeks that abortion is permitted. So I don't know what it would mean after that if suddenly the life of the mother. But if there are laws, I want to be careful about this, but if there are laws that say, even in the case of a threat to the life of the mother, you may not abort, then I think, yes, you would have a strong case that freedom of religion is being infringed by those states. But I mean, I know that such a law, by the way, such a suit has already been filed in Florida. We'll see as this proceeds through the courts. I think that this is one of those issues that is going to have now a lot of both legal challenges and adjustments and changes along the way.
If you're an outsider, let's say an Israeli, for example, who's looking at the United States today, and they see debates, it seems like the conversations in America are on two issues all the time. One, abortion. Two, gun laws, right? Like as if there's nothing else that goes on in the United States of America.
Right.
And I'm wondering, like, you know, if you look at the just kind of the last 20, 25 years, and, you know, you've been the pulpit, the rabbi of Sinai Temple for 25 years, how much has the conversation changed? Like how politicized has it all become? If you kind of look at the 30,000 feet perspective.
It is almost impossible to exaggerate the extent to which the conversation has changed. When I came to Sinai, I avoided political subjects, but it wasn't an issue. There were other issues that people talked about. But the three things, as you say, that I would say have increasingly dominated the conversation are anti-Semitism, which I think people feel in America has become a greater threat. As you said, gun laws to some extent, although not so much in my congregation. I think that's growing. And issues like abortion being just a sort of flagship issue for right-left divides. And the political divides in the congregation and the constant dealing with how do we bridge this and how do we speak to each other. And vaccinations were an absolutely explosively divisive issue in my congregation. People left over vaccine, the fact that we required vaccinations at a certain point for the kids, and some people left the school because of it. Some people left the synagogue when we said you have to be vaccinated to enter the building, which was another question. And then there were variations of masking policies and so on. And we changed this policy and that. It was unbelievably divisive and painful, and almost all, a pure right-left divide. So, yeah, it is not an easy time to be a leader of any community that is not thoroughly homogenous. But that just makes it a more important time to be a leader of a community that's not thoroughly homogenous.
So I want to ask you about another Supreme Court issue that's been controversial, about prayer in public schools. There was the decision this week that a coach who was fired for leading prayers, which he said were voluntary before football games, was wrongfully fired, that it was free speech and he should have been allowed to pray. What do you think about that? And how do you think that that will impact Jews in public schools?
So I have a little bit of an outsiderish perspective on this. I think that by and large, it's not going to be a terrible imposition to Jews. I mean, I know any number of Jews that go to Christian schools in America. They go to Episcopal schools. They go to other schools. They end up going to chapel or not going to chapel. They survive just fine. The real issue, I hate to say it, but it's true. The real issue is, do the people who go to these schools, whether they're public or private schools, and hear Christian prayers, do they have some understanding and rootedness in their own Judaism? If they do, then it's not so much of an issue. If your hands are full, then it doesn't matter if somebody's trying to give you a handout. the problem of American Jewry and prayer in public schools is much more a problem of American Jewry than a prayer in public schools, because those kids that are strong and self-identified, I think by and large, won't have a big problem. I mean, 50 years ago, it was universal, and Jews just understood that that was what you did in public schools. But as I said, this is kind of this might not be the majority perspective among my peers, but that's how I feel about it.
You announced recently that you're stepping down after 25 years at the helm, or at the lead, as the leader of the Sinai Temple, which is one of the largest synagogues in the Los Angeles area. And I guess maybe as a compliment to you, Rabbi Wolpe, I first should just mention that Newsweek once named you as America's top influential rabbi. You've written a number of books. You're an author and speaker. But to replace you, they had to appoint two rabbis. I got that right?
Well, I don't know if it's fair to say they had to, but what happened was...
And it had to be a married couple also. It couldn't just be, you know...
Many years ago, I had an intern, Nicole Guzik. When she was ordained, we hired her as an assistant rabbi. She, and like many rabbis now in rabbinical school, she married another rabbi, Erez Sherman, whose father was also a rabbi. So they moved out to Los Angeles. He served as an assistant in another congregation. She served in this congregation. It was very hard to negotiate Shabbat and other things. So eventually he came and became a rabbi on our staff as well. And so the two of them now are going to take over together, which is wonderful. They have different interests inside the congregation, programming and different skill sets. And I think it'll be one of their tremendous people. And I think it'll be a wonderful model for people to see that.
It sounds exciting, but I know, you know, this probably could be a 1 hour long answer to a very difficult question, but I'm curious if you could tell us, you know, 25 years is a long time to serve as a pulpit rabbi, and being a pulpit rabbi, I've often thought, is a very difficult role, right? High pressure, lots of different pressure coming from different directions, from congregants and members to organizations and civic and community leaders. It's all over the place. And halakha, Jewish law, being in the middle.
Yes.
How has it changed in 25 years? If you could give us the shorter version, if that's possible.
So the things that I would say is, first of all, it gets both harder and easier because you know your congregation, which means that when you do funerals, you know the people who passed away, and that gets harder and harder. It gets easier and easier because you know your congregation. So I remember when I was in rabbinical school, Simon Greenberg, who was like the dean of American conservative rabbis, I once asked him, how do you find something to talk about for 20 years? And he said, you actually find more to talk about because you know the people better and you have a relationship. And he was exactly right about that. So in some ways it gets easier, in some ways it gets harder. The climate of America has made it much more difficult because it's almost as if every shul has a R or a D above it. It's a Republican shul or a Democratic shul. And every political issue that comes out becomes now an occasion for religious divides. And that's been very, very hard. And I hope that will change. You know, there's a tide in the affairs of men, as Shakespeare wrote, and things will change one way or another. But that has not been a pleasant part of being a rabbi these years. The only other thing I would say is that, like many things in the world, what makes it hard is also what makes it rewarding. That is, you're there. The wedding depends on you. The funeral depends on you. The, you know, what is said at the bris, what is said at whether the person gets visited in the hospital, it depends on you. And so on one hand, you feel the burden. On the other hand, you feel the honor and the privilege. And so they go hand in hand.
So what is next for you after you retire as the rabbi of Sinai Temple?
So I'm going for a year to be a visiting scholar at the Harvard Divinity School. And then I hope to return to Los Angeles and New York. I'd like to be I'm trying to arrange to be in both places, not simultaneously. I'm not that much of a Kabbalist, but uh, but at least in seriatim, to be in both places to write and teach. That's what I want to do. I want to get out of the retail side of it, the side that is basically living other people's lives, which is what pulpit rabbis do, and go back, as I said, to writing and teaching, which I very much look forward to.
Well, Rabbi David Wolpe, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. Thank you very, very much. And best of luck going forward in this transition.
Thank you.
In the coming year.
A great pleasure to talk to you guys always. Love the Jerusalem Post. And thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Jerusalem Post podcast. You can find us always on Apple, Google Play, Spotify. Give us a high ranking. We need it. And share with your friends, family, and others. And we'll see you next week.